Borders Audio and Recorded Books present Forrest Gump by Winston Groom, narrated by Mark Hammer, and produced in the studios of Recorded Books, LLC. This work is copyrighted 1986 by Perch Creek Reality and Investments Corporation. This recording is copyrighted 1995 by Recorded Books, LLC. Winston Groom opens this novel with a quote from John Dryden. "There is a pleasure sure in being mad, which none but madmen know." And now, Forrest Gump.
Chapter 1. Let me say this. Being an idiot is no box of chocolates. People laugh, lose patience, treat you shabby. Now, they says folks supposed to be kind to the afflicted, but let me tell you, it ain't always that way. Even so, I got no complaints, 'cause I reckon I done live a pretty interesting life, so to speak. I've been an idiot since I was born. My IQ is near 70, which qualifies me, so they say. Probably, though, I'm closer to being an imbecile, or maybe even a moron, but personally, I'd rather think of myself as like a half-wit or something, and not no idiot. 'Cause when people think of an idiot, more than likely they'd be thinking of one of them Mongolian idiots, the ones with their eyes too close together, what look like Chinamen and drool a lot and play with themselves. Now, I'm slow, I grant you that, but I'm probably a lot brighter than folks think, 'cause what goes on in my mind is a sight different than what folks see. For instance, I can think things pretty good, but when I got to try saying or writing them, it kind of come out like jello or something. I'll show you what I mean. The other day, I'm walking down the street, and this man was out working in his yard. He'd got himself a bunch of shrubs to plant, and he says to me, "Forrest, you want to earn some money?" And I says, "Uh-huh." And so he sets me to moving dirt. Damn near 10 or 12 wheelbarrows of dirt in the heat of the day, trucking it all over creation. When I'm through, he reached in his pocket for a dollar. What I should have done was raise Cain about the low wages, but instead, I took the damn dollar, and all I could say was thanks, or something dumb sounding like that, and I went on down the street, wadding and unwadding that dollar in my hand, feeling like an idiot. You see what I mean? Now, I know something about idiots. Probably the only thing I do know about, but I done read up on them. All the way from that Dostoevsky guy's idiot, to King Lear's fool, and Faulkner's idiot, Benji, and even old Boo Radley in To Kill a Mockingbird. Now, he was a serious idiot. The one I like best, though, is old Lenny. In Of Mice and Men. Most of them writer fellas got it straight, 'cause they're idiots always smarter than people give them credit for. Hell, I'd agree with that. Any idiot would. Hey, hey. When I was born, my mama named me Forrest, 'cause of General Nathan Bedford Forrest, who fought in the Civil War. Mama always said we was kin to General Forrest's family some ways. And he was a great man, she'd say, except he started up the Ku Klux Klan after the war was over, and even my grandmama say they's a bunch of no-goods. Which I would tend to agree with, 'cause down here the grand exalted pish-posh, or whatever he calls himself, he operate a gun store in town. And once, when I was maybe 12 years old, I were walking by there and looking in the winder, and he got a big hangman's noose strung up inside. When he seen me watching, He done throwed it around his own neck and jerked it up like he is hanged, and let his tongue stick out and all so's to scare me. I done run off and hid in a parking lot behind some cars till somebody called the police, and they come and take me home to my mama. So whatever else old General Forrest done, starting up that Klan thing was not a good idea. Any idiot could tell you that. Nonetheless, that's how I got my name. My mama is a real fine person. Everybody says that. My daddy, he got killed just after I was born, so I never known him. He worked down to the docks as a longshoreman, and one day a crane was taking a big net load of bananas off one of them United Fruit Company boats, and something broke, and the bananas fell down on my daddy and squashed him flat as a pancake. One time I heard some men talking about the accident, say it was a hell of a mess, half ton of all them bananas and my daddy squished underneath. I don't care for bananas much myself, except for banana pudding. I like that all right. My mama got a little pension from the United Fruit people, and she took in boarders at our house, so we got by okay. When I was little, she kept me inside a lot, so's the other kids wouldn't bother me. In the summer afternoons, when it was real hot, she used to put me down in the parlor and pull the shades so it was dark and cool and fix me a pitcher of limeade. Then she'd sit there and talk to me. Just talk on and on about nothing in particular. Like a personal talk to a dog or cat. But I got used to it and liked it 'cause her voice made me feel real safe and nice. At first, when I was grown up, she'd let me go out and play with everybody. But then she found out they was teasing me and all. And one day a boy hit me in the back with a stick while they was chasing me, and it raised some fearsome welt. After that, she told me not to play with them boys anymore. I started trying to play with the girls, but that weren't much better 'cause they all run away from me. Mama thought it'd be good for me to go to the public school, 'cause maybe it would help me to be like everybody else. But after I'd been there a little while, they come and told Mama I oughtn't to be in there with everybody else. They let me finish out first grade, though. Sometimes I'd sit there while the teacher was talking, and I don't know what was going on in my mind, but I'd start looking out the window at the birds and squirrels and things that was climbing and setting in a big old oak tree outside. Then the teacher'd come over and fuss at me. Sometimes I'd just get this real strange thing come over me and start shouting and all. Then she'd make me go out and sit on a bench in the hall. And the other kids, they'd never play with me or nothing, except to chase me or get me to start hollering so they could laugh at me. All except Jenny Curran, who at least didn't run away from me, and sometimes she'd let me walk next to her going home after class. But the next year, they put me in another sort of school, and let me tell you, it was weird. It was like they'd gone around collecting all the funny fellers they could find and put them all together, ranging from my age and younger to big old boys about 16 or 17. They was retards of all kinds and spasmos and kids that couldn't even eat or go to the toilet by themselves. I was probably the best of the lot. They was one big fat boy, must have been 14 or so, and he is afflicted with some kind of thing made him shake like he's in an electric chair or something. Miss Margaret, our teacher, made me go in the bathroom with him when he had to go, so's he wouldn't do nothing weird. He done it anyway, though. I didn't know no way of stopping him, so I just locked myself in one of the stalls and stay there till he's through, and walking back to the class. I stayed in that school for about 5 or 6 years. It wasn't all bad, though. They'd let us paint with our fingers and make little things. But mostly, it was just teaching us how to do stuff like tie up our shoes and not slobber food or get wild and yell and holler and throw shit around. They weren't no book learning to speak of, except to show us how to read street signs and things like the difference between the men's and the ladies' rooms. With all them serious nuts in there, it would have been impossible to conduct anything more than that anyway. Also, I think it was for the purpose of keeping us out of everybody else's hair. Who the hell wants a bunch of retards running around loose? Even I could understand that. When I got to be 13, some pretty unusual things began to happen. First off, I started to grow. I grew 6 inches in 6 months, and my mama was all the time having to let out my pants. Also, I commenced to grow out. By the time I was 16, I was 6'6" and weighed 242 pounds. I know that 'cause they took me in and weighed me. Said they just couldn't believe it. What happened next caused a real change in my life. One day, I'm strolling down the street on my way home from nut school, and a car stopped alongside of me. This guy called me over and asked my name. I told him, and then he asked what school I go to and how come he ain't seen me around. When I tell him about the nut school, he asked if I'd ever played football. I shook my head. I guess I might have told him I'd seen kids playing it, but they never let me play. But like I said, I ain't too good at long conversation, and so I just shook my head. That was about 2 weeks after school begun again. 3 days or so later, they come and got me out of the nut school. My mama was there, and so was the guy in the car, and 2 other people what looked like goons, who I guess was present in case I was to start something. They took all the stuff out of my desk and put it in a brown paper bag and told me to say goodbye to Miss Margaret, and all of a sudden, she commenced to start crying and give me a big old hug. Then I got to say goodbye to all the other nuts, and they was drooling and spasmoing and beating on the desks with their fists. And then I was gone. Mama rode up in the front seat with the guy, and I sitting back in between them goons, just like police done in them old movies when they took you downtown. Except we didn't go downtown. We went to the new high school they'd built. When we got there, they took me inside to the principal's office, and Mama and me and the guy went in while the 2 goons waited in the hall. The principal was an old gray-haired man with a stain on his tie and baggy pants who looked like he could have come out of the nut school himself. We all sat down, and he begun explaining things and asking me questions, and I just nodded my head. But what they wanted was for me to play football. That much I figured out on my own. Turns out, the guy in the car was a football coach named Fellers. And that day, I didn't go to no class or nothing, but Coach Fellers, he took me back to the locker room, and one of the goons rounded me up a football suit with all them pads and stuff, and a real nice plastic helmet with a thing in front to keep my face from getting squished in. Only thing was, they couldn't find no shoes to fit me, so's I had to use my sneakers till they could order the shoes. Coach Fellers and the goons got me dressed up in the football suit, and then It made me undress again and then do it all over again 10 or 20 times till I could do it by myself. One thing I had trouble with for a while was that jock strap thing, 'cause I couldn't see no real good reason for wearing it. Well, they tried explaining it to me, and then one of the goons says to the other that I'm a dummy or something like that. And I guess he thought I wouldn't understand him, but I did, on account of I pay special attention to that kind of shit. Not that it hurt my feelings. Hell, I've been called a sight worse than that. But I took notice of it nonetheless. After a while, a bunch of kids started coming into the locker room and taking out their football stuff and getting into it. And then we all went outside, and Coach Fellows got everybody together, and he stood me up in front of them and introduced me. He was saying a bunch of shit that I wasn't following real close, 'cause I was half scared to death, on account of nobody had ever introduced me before to a bunch of strangers. But afterwards, some of the others come up and shook my hand and say they's glad I'm here and all. Then Coach Fellows blowed a whistle, what like to make me leap out of my skin, and everybody started jumping around to get exercise. It's a kind of long story what all happened next, but anyway, I begun to play football. Coach Fellows and one of the goons helped me out special since I didn't know how to play. We had this thing where you're supposed to block people, and they were trying to explain it all, but when we tried it a bunch of times, everybody seemed to be getting disgusted, 'cause I couldn't remember what I was supposed to do. Then they tried this other thing they called the defense, where they put three guys in front of me and I'm supposed to get through them and grab the guy with the football. The first part was easier, 'cause I could just shove the other guy's heads down, but they were unhappy with the way I grabbed the guy with the ball. And finally, they made me go and tackle a big oak tree about 15 or 20 times to get the feel of it, I suppose. But after a while, when they figured I'd learned something from the oak tree, they put me back with the three guys and the ball carrier, and then got mad I didn't jump on him real vicious-like after I moved the others out of the way. I took a lot of abuse that afternoon, but when we quit practicing, I went in to see Coach Fellows and told him I didn't want to jump on the ball guy 'cause I was afraid of hurting him. Coach, he say that it wouldn't hurt him 'cause he was in his football suit and was protected. And the truth is, I wasn't so much afraid of hurting him as I was that he'd get mad at me and they'd start chasing me again if I wasn't real nice to everybody. And to make a long story short, it took me a while to get the hang of it all. In the meantime, I got to go to class. In the nut school, we really didn't have that much to do, but here they was far more serious about things. Somehow they'd worked it out so's I had 3 homeroom classes where you just sat there and did whatever you wanted, and then 3 other classes where there was a lady who was teaching me how to read. Just the 2 of us. She was real nice and pretty, and more than once or twice I had nasty thoughts about her. Miss Henderson was the name. About the only class I liked was lunch, but I guess you wouldn't call that a class. At the nut school, my mama would fix me a sandwich and a cookie and a piece of fruit, except no bananas, and I'd take it to school with me. But in this school, there's a cafeteria with 9 or 10 different things to eat, and I'd have trouble making up my mind what I wanted. I think somebody must have said something, 'cause after a week or so, Coach Fellows came up to me and said to just go ahead and eat all I wanted, 'cause it had been taken care of. Hot damn. Guess who should be in my homeroom class but Jenny Curran. She come up to me in the hall and say she remembered me from first grade. She is all growed up now, with pretty black hair, and she is long-legged and had a beautiful face, and there's other things, too, I dare not mention. The football was not going exactly to the liking of Coach Fellers. He seemed displeased a lot and was always shouting at people. He shouted at me, too. They tried to figure out some way for me to just stay put and keep other folks from grabbing our guy carrying the ball. But that didn't work, except when they ran the ball right up the middle of the line. Coach wasn't too happy with my tackling, neither. And let me tell you, I spent a lot of time at that oak tree. But I just couldn't get to where I would throw myself at the ball guy like they wanted me to. Something kept me from it. Then, one day, an event happened that changed all that, too. In the cafeteria, I'd start getting my food and going over to sit next to Jenny Curran. I wouldn't say nothing, but she was just about the only person in the school I knew halfways, and it felt good sitting there with her. Most of the time, she didn't pay me no attention and talked with other people. At first, I'd been sitting with some of the football players, but they acted like I was invisible or something. At least Jenny Curran acted like I was there. But after a while of this, I started to notice this other guy was there a lot, too. And he starts making wisecracks about me, saying shit like, "How's Dumbo?" and all. And it's gone on for a week or two, and I'm saying nothing. But finally I says, I can't hardly believe I said it even now, but I says, "I ain't no Dumbo." And the guy just looks at me and starts laughing. And Jenny Curran, she say to the guy to keep quiet, but he takes a carton of milk and pours it in my lap. And I jump up and run out, 'cause it scares me. A day or so later, that guy come up to me in the hall and says he gonna get me. All day I was afraid terribly, and later that afternoon, when I was leaving to go to the gym, there he is with a bunch of his friends. I tried to go the other way, but he come up to me and started pushing me on the shoulders. And he's saying all kinds of bad things, calling me a stupo and all. And then he hit me in the stomach. It didn't hurt so much, but I was starting to cry. And I turned and begun to run, and heard him behind me, and the others was running after me too. I run as fast as I could toward the gym, across the practice football field, and suddenly I seen Coach Feller sitting up in the bleachers watching me. The guys who was chasing me stop and go away, and Coach Feller's, he's got this real peculiar look on his face and tell me to get suited up right away. A while later, he come in the locker room with these plays drawn on a piece of paper, three of them, and say for me to memorize them best I can. That afternoon, at the football practice, he lined everybody up in two teams, and suddenly the quarterback give me the ball, and I'm supposed to run outside the right end of the line to the goalpost. When they all start chasing me, I run fast I can. It was seven or eight of them before they could drag me down. Coach Fellers is mighty happy, jumping up and down and yelling and slapping everybody on the back. We'd run a lot of races before to see how fast we could run, but I get a lot faster when I'm being chased, I guess. What idiot wouldn't? Anyway, I become a lot more popular after that, and the other guys on the team started being nicer to me. We had our first game, and I was scared to death, but they give me the ball, and I run over the goal line two or three times, and people never been kinder to me after that. That high school certainly begun to change things in my life, It even got to where I liked to run with the football, except it was mostly that they made me run round the sides, because I still couldn't get to where I liked to just run over people like you do in the middle. One of the goons comments that I am the largest high school halfback in the entire world. I do not think he meant it as a compliment. Otherwise, I was learning to read a lot better with Miss Henderson. She gave me Tom Sawyer and two other books I can't remember, and I took them home and read them all. But then she gave me a test where I don't do so hot. But I sure enjoyed them books. After a while, I went back to sitting next to Jenny Curran in the cafeteria, and there weren't no more trouble for a long time. But then one day, in the springtime, I was walking home from school, and who should appear but the boy that poured the milk in my lap and chased me that day. He got himself a stick and started calling me things like moron and stupo. Some other people was watching, and then along comes Jenny Curran, and I'm about to take off again, but then for no reason I know, I just didn't do it. That feller take his stick and poke me in the stomach with it, and I says to myself, "The hell with this." And I grabbed a hold of his arm, and with my other hand, I knock him upside the head, and that was the end of that, more or less. That night, my mama get a phone call from the boy's parents. Say if I lay a hand on their son again, they's going to call the authorities and have me put away. I tried to explain it to my mama, and she say she understand, but I could tell she is worried. She tell me that since I'm so huge now, I got to watch myself, 'cause I might hurt somebody. And I nodded and promised her I wouldn't hurt nobody else. That night, when I lying in bed, I heard her crying to herself in a room. But what that did for me, knocking that boy upside the head, put a definite new light on my football playing. Next day, I asked Coach Phillips to let me run the ball straight on, and he said, "Okay." And I run over maybe 4 or 5 guys till I'm in the clear, and they all had to start chasing me again. That year, I made the all-state football team. I couldn't hardly believe it. My mama gave me 2 pair of socks and a new shirt on my birthday. And she done saved up and bought me a new suit that I wore to get the All-State Football Award. First suit I ever had. Mama tied my tie for me, and off I went.
Chapter 2.
The All-State Football Banquet was to be held in a little town called Flumington, what Coach Phillips described as a switch up the railroad tracks. We was put on a bus. There's 5 or 6 of us from this area who won the prize, and we was trucked up there. It was an hour or two before we arrived, and the bus didn't have no toilet. And I drank 2 Slurpees before we left. So when we get to Flumington, I really gotta go bad. The thing was held at the Flumington High School Auditorium, and when we get inside, me and some of the others find the toilet. Somehow, though, when I go to unzip my pants, the zipper is stuck in my shirt tail and won't come down. After a bit of this, a nice little guy from a rival school goes out and finds Coach Phillips, and he come in with the 2 goons, and they be trying to get my pants open. And one of the goons say the only way to get it down is just rip it apart. At this, Coach Phillips put his hands on his hips and say, I suppose you expect me to send this boy out there with his fly unzipped and his thing hanging out? Now, what kind of an impression do you think that would make? Then he turned to me and say, Forrest, you just got to keep a lid on it till this thing's over, and then we get it open for you. Okay? And I nod, 'cause I don't know what else to do, but I figured I'd be in for a long evening. When we get out to the auditorium, there's a million people all sitting there at tables, smiling and clapping as we come out. We is put up at a big long table on the stage in front of everybody, and my worst fears was realized about the long evening. Seemed like every soul in the room got up to make a speech, even the waiters and janitor. I wished my mama could have been there, 'cause she'd have helped me, but she back at home in bed with the grip. Finally, it come time to get handed out prizes, which was little gold-colored footballs, and when our names was called, we was supposed to go up to the microphone and take the prize and say thank you. And they also told us if anybody has anything else he wants to say, to keep it short, on account of we want to be getting out of there before the turn of the century. Most everybody had got their prize and said thank you, and then it come my turn. Somebody on the microphone call out, Forrest Gump, which, if I hadn't told you before, is my last name, and I stand up and go over and they hand me the prize. I lean over to the mic and say, thank you, and everybody starts to cheer and clap and stand up in their seats. I suppose somebody told them beforehand I'm some kind of idiot, and they're making a special effort to be nice. But I'm so surprised by all this, I don't know what to do, so I just kept standing there. Then everybody hush up, and the man at the mic, he lean over and ask me if I got anything else I want to say. So I says, I got to pee. Everybody in the audience didn't say nothing for a few moments and just started looking funny at each other. Then they begun a sort of low mumbling, and Coach Fellas come up and grab me by the arm and haul me back to my seat. Rest of the night, he been glaring at me. But after the banquet is over, Coach and the goons done take me back to the bathroom and rip open my pants, and I done peed a bucket. Gump, Coach say after I'm finished, you sure got away with words. Now, next year wasn't too eventful, except somebody put out the word that an idiot got himself on the all-state football team, and a bunch of letters started coming in from all around the country. Mama collected them all and started keeping a scrapbook. One day, a package come from New York City that contained an official baseball signed by the entire New York Yankees baseball team. It was the best thing ever happened to me. I treasure that ball like a gold brick, till one day when I was out tossing it around in the yard, a big old dog come up and grabbed it out of the air and chewed it up. Things like that always happening to me. One day, Coach Fellas called me in and take me into the principal's office. And there's a man there from up to the university who shook my hand and asked me whether I ever thought about playing football in college. He say they've been watching me. I shook my head 'cause I hadn't. Everybody seemed to be in awe of this man, bowing and scraping, calling him Mr. Bryant. But he say for me to call him Bear, which I thought was a funny name, except he do look similar to a bear in some respects. Coach Fellas point out that I am not the brightest person, but the bear, He say that's plenty true of most of his players, and that he figures to get me special help in my studies. A week later, they give me a test with all sorts of screwy questions, the like of which I'm not familiar with. After a while, I get bored and stop taking the test. 2 days afterward, the bear come back again, and I get hauled into the principal's office by Coach Fellers. Bear, looking distressed, but he's still being nice, he asks me, have I done tried my best on that test? I nod my head, but the principal be rolling his eyes, and the bear say, well, this is unfortunate then, 'cause the score appears to indicate that this boy is an idiot. The principal be nodding his head now, and Coach Fellers is standing there with his hands in his pockets, looking sour. It seemed to be the end of my college football prospects. The fact that I were too dumb to play college football didn't seem to impress the United States Army none. It was my last year at high school, and in the springtime, everybody else graduated. They let me set up on the stage, though, and even give me a black robe to put on, and when it come time, the principal announced they was going to give me a special diploma. I got up to go to the microphone, and the two goons stand up and go with me. I suppose so's I don't make no remarks like I did at the All-State football thing. My mama is down in the front row, crying and wringing her hands, and I feel real good, like I actually done accomplished something. But when we get back home, I finally realize why she bawling and carrying on. There was a letter come from the Army, say I got to report to the local DAFT board or some such. I didn't know what the deal was, but my mama did. It was 1968, and there's all sorts of shit fixing to happen. Mama, give me a letter from the school principal to hand to the DAFT board people, but somehow I lost it on the way there. It was a loony scene. There was a big colored guy in an army suit yelling at people and dividing them up into bunches. We was all standing there, and he come up and shout, all right, I want half of you to go over there, and half of you to go over here, and the other half of you to stay put. Everybody milling around and looking bewildered. And even I could figure out this guy's a moron. They took me in a room and line us up and tell us to remove our clothes. I ain't much for that, but everybody else done it, and so I did too. They looking at us every place, eyes, noses, mouths, ears, even our private parts. At one point, they tell me, bend over. And when I do, somebody jams his finger up my ass. That's it. I turn and grab that bastard and knocked him upside the head. There was suddenly a big commotion, and a bunch of people run up and jump on top of me. However, I am used to that treatment. I throw them off and run out the door. When I get home and tell my mama what happened, she all upset, but she say, don't worry, Forrest. Everything gonna be okay. It ain't. Next week, a van pull up at our house, and a number of men in army suits and shiny black helmets come up to the door, be asking for me. I'm hiding up in my room, but Mama come up and say they just want to give me a ride back down to the DAFT board. All the way there, they be watching me real close. Like I'm some kind of maniac. There was a door that lead to a big office where there's an older man all dressed up in a shiny uniform, and he eyeing me pretty careful, too. They set me down and shove another test in front of me, and while it's one hell of a lot easier than the college football test, it still ain't no piece of cake. When I'm done, they take me to another room, where these four or five guys sitting at a long table would start asking me questions and passing around what looked like the test I took. Then they all get into a huddle, and when they finish, one of them sign a paper and hand it to me. When I take it home, Mama read it and began pulling at her hair and weeping and praising the Lord, 'cause it say I am temporarily deferred on account of I am a numbnuts. Something else occurred during that week that was a major event in my life. There was this lady boarder living with us that worked down to the telephone company as an operator. Miss French was her name. She's a real nice lady, what kept mostly to herself. But one night, when it was terribly hot and there was thunderstorms, she stuck her head out the door to her room as I was walking by and say, "Forrest, I just got a box of nice divinity this afternoon. Would you like a piece?" And I say, "Yes." And she bring me into her room, and there on the dresser is the divinity. She give me a piece of it. Then she asks if I want another, and she points for me to sit down on the bed. I must have ate 10 or 15 pieces of the divinity, and lightning was flashing outside, and thunder, and the curtains was blowing, and Miss French kind of pushes me and makes me lie back on the bed. She commences to start stroking me in a personal way. "Just keep your eyes closed," she say, "and everything will be all right." Next thing you know, there is something happening that had not happened before. I cannot say what it was, because I was keeping my eyes closed, and also because my mama would have killed me. But let me tell you this. It gave me an entirely new outlook on things for the future. The problem was that while Miss French was a nice, kind lady, the things that she'd done to me that night was the kinds of things I'd preferred to have done to me by Jenny Curran. And yet there's no way I could see to even begin getting that accomplished, 'cause what with the way I am, it's not so easy to ask anyone for a date. And that's to put it mildly. But on account of my new experience, I got up the courage to ask my mama what to do about Jenny, though I certainly didn't say nothing about me and Miss French. Mama said she'll take care of it for me, and she called up Jenny Curran's mama and explained the situation to her, and the next evening, lo and behold, who should appear at our door but Jenny Curran herself. She's all dressed up in a white dress and a pink flower in her hair, and she looked like nothing I have ever dreamed of. She come inside, and Mama took her to the parlor and give her an ice cream float and called for me to come down from my room, where I'd run to as soon as I seen Jenny Curran coming up the walk. I'd have rather had 5,000 people chasing me than to come out of my room just then. But Mama come up and take me by the hand and lead me down and give me an ice cream float, too. That made it better. Mama said we can go to the movies, and she'd give Jenny $3 as we walk out of the house. Jenny ain't never been nicer, talking and laughing, and I'm nodding and grinning like an idiot. The movie was just 4 or 5 blocks from our house, and Jenny went up and got some tickets, and we went in and sat down. She asked me if I want some popcorn, and when she come back from getting it, the picture done started. It is a movie about two people, a man and a lady called Bonnie and Clyde that robbed banks, and there was some interesting other people in it also. But it was a lot of killing and shooting and shit like that, too. It seemed to me funny that folks would be shooting and killing one another that way, so I laughed a lot when that went on, and whenever I did, Jenny Curran seemed to squinch down in a seat a lot. Halfway through the movie, she was almost squinched down to the floor. I suddenly saw this and figured she'd somehow fell out of a seat, so I reached over and grabbed her by the shoulder to lift her up again. As I did this, I heard something tear, and I looked down, and Jenny Curran's dress is ripped completely open and everything is hanging out. I took my other hand to try to cover her up, but she started making noises and flail about wild-like, and me, I'm trying to hold on to her so she don't fall down again or come undone, and there's people round us looking back trying to see what all the commotion is about. Suddenly, a fella come down the aisle and shine a bright light right on Jenny and me. But being exposed and all, she commenced to shriek and wail, and then she jump up and run out of the show. Next thing I know, two men come and tell me to get up, and I follow them to an office. A few minutes later, four policemen arrive and ask me to come with them. They show me to a police car, and two get in front, and two get in back with me, just like it was with Coach Fella's goons, except this time we do go downtown, and they escort me to a room and jab my fingers onto a pad, and I get my picture taken, and they throw me in jail. It was a horrible experience. I was worried all the time about Jenny. But after a bit, my mama showed up and come in, wiping her eyes with a handkerchief and twisting her fingers, and I knowed I'm in the doghouse again. There was some kind of ceremony a few days later down to the courthouse. My mama dressed me in my suit and took me there, and we met a nice man with a mustache carrying a big purse who told the judge a bunch of things. Then some other people, including my mama, say some other shit, and finally it was my turn. The man with the mustache took me by the arm so's I'd stand up, and the judge asked me how all this done happened. I couldn't figure out what to say, so I just shrugged my shoulders, and then he asks if there's anything else I want to add, and so I says, I got to pee. 'Cause we've been sitting there almost half a day and I'm about to bust. The judge, he leaned forward from behind his big old desk and peer at me like I'm a Mars man or something. Then the fella with the mustache speaks up, and following this, the judge tells him to take me to the toilet, which he does. I look back as we leave in the room and see poor old mama holding her head and daubing at her eyes with the handkerchief. Anyhow, when I get back, the judge be scratching his chin, and he say the whole deal is very peculiar, but that he think I ought to go in the army or something which might help straighten me out. My mama inform him that the United States Army won't have me, account of I'm an idiot, but that this very morning a letter done come from up to the university saying that if I will play football for them, I can go to school there scot-free. The judge say that sounds kind of peculiar too, but it's okay with him as long as I get my big ass out of town. The next morning, I'm all packed up, and Mama, she take me to the bus station and put me on the bus. I was looking out the window, and there's Mama, crying and wiping her eyes with a handkerchief. That's getting to be a scene I know too well. It is stamped permanent into my memory. Anyhow, They started up the bus, and away I went. Chapter 3. When we get up to the university, Coach Bryant, he come out to the gym where we were all sitting in our shorts and sweatshirts and begin making a speech. It about the same kind of speech Coach Fellows would make, except even a simpleton like myself could tell this man meant business. His speech, short and sweet, and conclude with the statement that the last man on the bus to the practice field will get a ride there not on the bus, but on Coach Bryant's shoe instead. Yes, sirree, we do not doubt his word, and stack ourselves into the bus like flapjacks. All this was during the month of August, which in the state of Alabama is somewhat hotter than it is elsewhere. That is to say, that if you put an egg on top of your football helmet, it would be fried sunny side up in about 10 seconds. Course nobody ever tried that, on account of it might get Coach Bryant angry. That was the one thing nobody wished to do, because life was almost intolerable as it was. Coach Bryant have his own goons to show me around. They take me to where I was going to stay, which is a nice brick building on the campus that somebody says is called the Ape Dorm. Them goons escort me over there in a car and lead me upstairs to my room. Unfortunately, what might have looked nice from the outside was not true for the inside. At first, it appeared that nobody had lived in this building for a long time. There was so much dirt and shit around, and most of the doors had been torn off the hinges and bashed in, as most of the windows are busted out, too. A few of the fellers is lying on their cots inside, wearing very little, cause it about 110 degrees hot in there, and flies and things be humming and buzzing. In the hall, there is a big stack of newspapers, which at first I afraid they're going to make us read, it being college and all, but soon I learned they're for putting down on the floor so you don't have to step on all the dirt and shit when you walk around. The goons take me to my room and say they be hoping to find my roommate there, whose name is Curtis somebody, but he nowhere to be found. So they get my stuff unpacked and show me where the bathroom is, which look worse than what you might expect to find at a one-pump gasoline station, and they be on their way. But before they go, one of the goons say Curtis and me should get on fine, because both of us have about as much brains as an eggplant. I look real hard at the goon what said that, because I be tired of hearing all that shit. But he tell me to drop down and give him 50 push-ups. After that, I just be doing what I'm told. I went to sleep on my cot after spreading a sheet over it to cover up the dirt, and was having a dream about sitting down in the parlor with my mama like we used to do when it was hot, and she'd fix me a limeade and talk to me hour after hour. Then suddenly the door of the room done crashed in flat and scared me half to death. A fella be standing there in the doorway with a wild look on his face, eyes all bugged out, no teeth in front, nose look like a yellow squash, and his hair standing straight up like he done stuck his thing in a light socket. I figure this be Curtis. He come inside the room, like he expecting somebody to pounce on him, looking from side to side, and walk right over the door that he just caved in. Curtis ain't very tall, but he looked like an icebox otherwise. First thing he asks me is where I'm from. When I say Mobile, he say that is a candy-ass town, and informs me he's from Op, where they make peanut butter, and if I don't like it, he's going to open up a jar himself and butter my butt with it. That was the extent of our conversation for a day or so. That afternoon at football practice, it'd be about 10,000 degrees hot on the field, and all Coach Bryant's goons running around scowling and yelling at us, making us exercise. My tongue hanging down like it was a necktie or something, but I trying to do the right thing. Finally, they divides up everybody and puts me with backs, and we start to run pass patterns. Now, before I come up to the university, they done sent me a package which contained about 1,000,000 different football plays, and I done asked Coach Fellas what I'm supposed to do with it, and he just shake his head sadly and say not to try to do nothing, just to wait until I get to the university and let them figure something out. I wish I hadn't taken Coach Fellas' advice now, 'cause when I run out for my first pass, I done turned the wrong way, and the head goon come rushing up, hollering and shouting at me, and when he stopped shouting, he asked me, don't I study the plays they send me? When I says, he commenced to jump up and down and flail his arms like hornets is upon him, and when he calmed down, he tell me to go run 5 laps round the field while he consult with Coach Bryant about me. Coach Bryant be sitting up in a great big tower, looking down on us like the great God Bud. I'm running the laps and watching the goon climb up there, and when he get to the top and says peace, Coach Bryant crane his neck forward, and I feel his eyes burning hot on my big stupid ass. Suddenly, a voice come over the megaphone for everybody to hear, say, Forrest Gump, report to the coaching tower. And I seen Coach Bryant and the goon climbing down. All the time I be running over there, I am wishing I were running backwards instead. But imagine my surprise when I see Coach Bryant smiling. He motioned me over to some bleachers, and we sat down, and he asked me again if I'd not learned them plays they sent me. I began to explain what Coach Fellas had told me, but Coach Bryant, he stopped me and saved me to get back in the line and start catching passes. And then I told him something else I guess he didn't want to hear, which was that I'd never even caught a pass at high school, 'cause they figured it hard enough to get me to remember where our own goal line is, let alone running around trying to grab the ball out of the air, too. At this news, Coach Bryant get a real odd squint in his eyes, and he'd look off in the distance, as if he was looking all the way to the moon or something. Then he tell the goon to go fetch a football, and when the football come, Coach Bryant himself tell me to run out a little ways and turn around. When I do, he throwed the football at me. I see it coming almost like slow motion, but it bounce off my fingers and fall on the ground. Coach Bryant be nodding his head up and down like he should have figured this out earlier. But somehow, I get the idea he is not pleased. From the time I'm little, every time I do something wrong, my mama, she'd say, Forrest, you got to be careful, 'cause they're going to put you away. I was so scared of being put in this away place, I'd always try to be better. But I'm damned if there's a worse place they could have sent me than this ape dorm thing I'm living in. People be doing shit they wouldn't have tolerated even in the nut school. Ripping out the toilets, for instance, so you'd go to the bathroom and wouldn't find nothing but a hole in the floor to shit in. and they'd have heaved the toilet out the window onto the top of somebody's car driving past. One night, some big old goofball what played in the line got out a rifle and commenced to shoot out all the windows in somebody's fraternity house across the street. The campus cops come rushing over, but the fella dropped a big outboard motor he found someplace out the window onto the top of the cop car. Coach Bryant make him run a bunch of extra laps for doing that. Curtis and me ain't getting along so hot, and I never been so lonely. I miss my mama and want to go back home. The trouble with Curtis is I don't understand him. Everything he say got so many cuss words in it. Time I get to figuring out what they are, I miss his point. Most of the time, I gather his point is that he ain't happy about something. Curtis had a car, and he used to give me a ride to practice. But one day, I go to meet him, and he cussing and growling and bent over a big drain grate in the street. Seems he's got a flat tire, and when he go to change it, he put the lug nuts in his hubcap and accidentally knock 'em down into the drain. We fixin' to be late to practice, which was not real good to do, so as I say to Curtis, "Why don't you take one lug nut off each of them three other tiles? And that way you'll have three nuts on each tire, which ought to be enough to get us to practice." Curtis stopped cussing for a moment and look up at me and say, "You supposed to be a idiot. How you figure that out?" And I say, "Maybe I am a idiot, but at least I ain't stupid." And at this, Curtis jump up and commence chasing me with a tie tool, calling me every terrible thing he can think up, and that pretty much ruined our relationship. After that, I decide I got to find another place to stay. So when we get off from practice, I gone down into the basement of the ape dorm and spent the rest of the night there. It wasn't no dirtier than the upstairs rooms, and there was an electric light bulb. Next day, I moved my cot down there, and from then on, it was where I lived. Meantime, school has done started, and they got to figure out what to do with me. There was a guy with the athletic department that seemed to do nothing but figure out how to get dummos to where they could pass a class. Some of the classes were supposed to be easy, such as physical education, and they enrolled me in that. But also, I've got to take one English course and one science or math, and there's no getting around that. What I learnt later was that there were certain teachers that would give a football player a sort of break, meaning that they'd appreciate he is consumed with playing football and cannot spend much of his time on school. There was one of these teachers in the science department, but unfortunately the only class he taught was something called Intermediate Light, which was apparently for graduate physics majors or something. But they put me in there anyhow, even though I didn't know physics from phys ed. I wasn't so lucky in English. They apparently didn't have no sympathetic people over in that department, so they told me just to go ahead and take the class and fail it, and they'd figure out something else later. In Intermediate Light, they provide me with a textbook that weighed 5 pounds and looked like a Chinaman wrote it. But every night I take it down to the basement and sit on my cot under the light bulb. And after a while, for some peculiar reason, it begun to make sense. What did not make sense was why we were supposed to be doing it in the first place, but figuring out them equations was easy as pie.
Professor Hooks was my teacher's name, and after the first test, he asked me to come to his office after class. He say, "Forrest, I want you to tell me the truth. Did somebody provide you the answers to these questions?" And I shake my head. And then he hand me a sheet of paper with a problem written on it and says for me to sit down and figure it out. When I'm through, Professor Hooks look at what I done and shake his head and say, "Great God Almighty." English class was another deal entirely. The teacher is a Mr. Boone, and he a very stern person who talk a lot. At the end of the first day, he say for us to sit down that night and write a short autobiography of ourselves for him. It's just about the most difficult thing I ever try to do, but I stay up most of the night thinking and writing, and I just say whatever come to mind on account of they told me to fail the class anyhow. A few days later, Mr. Boone start handing back our papers, and he criticizing and making fun of everybody's autobiography. Then he come to what I done, and I figure I'm in the doghouse for sure. But he hold up my paper and start reading it out loud to everybody, and he commences laughing, and everybody else is too. I told about being in the nut school and playing football for Coach Fellas and going to the All-State football banquet and about the Daft Board and Jenny Curran and the movie and all. When he's through, Mr. Boone, he say, "Now here is originality. Here is what I want." And everybody turn and look at me, and he says, "Mr. Gump, you ought to think about getting into the creative writing department. How did you think this up?" And I says, "I got to pee." Mr. Boone kind of jumped back for a second. Then he bust out laughing, and so's everybody else, and he said, "Mr. Gump, you are a very amusing fellow." And so, I'm surprised again. The first football game was on a Saturday a few weeks later. Most of the time, practice had been pretty bad till Coach Bryant figured out what to do with me, which was about what Coach Fellers had done at Haskew. They just give me the ball and let me run. I run good that day and score 4 touchdowns. And we whip the University of Georgia 35-3, and everybody's slapping me on the back till it hurt. After I get cleaned up, I phone my mama, and she done listened to the game over the radio and is so happy she can bust. That night, everybody going to parties and shit, but nobody asks me to any, so I go down to the basement. I'm there a while when I hear this kind of music coming from someplace upstairs. And it's real pretty-like, and I don't know why, but I went on up there to find out what it was. There was this guy, Bubba, sitting in his room, playing a mouth organ. He'd broke his foot in practice and couldn't play and didn't have nowhere to go either. He let me sit on a cot and listen to him. We didn't talk or nothing. He just sitting on one cot and me on the other, and he's playing his harmonica. And after about an hour, I asked him if I could try it, and he says, "Okay." Little did I know that it would change my life forever. After I'd played around on the thing for a while, I got to where I could play pretty good, and Bubba was going crazy, saying he'd never heard such good shit. After it got late, Bubba says for me to take the harmonica with me, and I did, and played it a long time till I got sleepy and went to bed. Next day, Sunday,
I went to take the harmonica back to Bubba, but he saved me to keep it, 'cause he got another one, and I was real happy, and went for a walk and sat down under a tree and played all day long till I run out of things to play. It was late in the afternoon, and the sun was almost gone when I begun to walk back to the ape dome. I was going across the quadrangle when suddenly I hear this girl's voice shout out, "Forrest!" I turn around, and who should be behind me but Jenny Curran. She has a big smile on her face, and she come up and took me by the hand and says she saw me play football yesterday and how good I was and all. Turns out she ain't mad or anything about what happened in the movie and says it ain't my fault. It was just one of them things. She asks if I want to have a Coca-Cola with her. It was too nice to believe, sitting there with Jenny Curran. And she says she's taking classes in music and drama and that she's planning on being an actress or a singer. She's also playing in a little band that do folk music stuff and tells me they're going to be at the Student Union building tomorrow night and for me to come by. Let me tell you, I can hardly wait.
This ends Disc 1. Forrest Gump, Disc 2.
Chapter 4.
Now, there is a secret thing that Coach Bryant and them done figured out, and nobody's supposed to mention it even to ourselves. They've been teaching me how to catch a football pass. Every day after practice, I've been working with two goons and a quarterback, running out and catching passes, running out and catching passes, till I'm so exhausted my tongue hanging down to my navel. But I getting to where I can catch 'em. And Coach Bryant, he say this gonna be our secret weapon. Like an atom bomb or something. 'Cause after a while, them other teams gonna figure out they ain't throwing me the ball and will not be watching for it. Then, Coach Bryant say, we's gonna turn your big ass loose, 6'6", 240 pounds, and run 100 yards in 9.5 seconds flat. It is gonna be a sight. Bubba and me is real good friends by now, and he helped me learn some new songs on the harmonica. Sometimes he come down to the basement and we sit around and play long together. But Bubba say I am far better than he ever will be. I gotta tell you that if it weren't for that harmonica music, I might have just packed up and gone home. But it made me feel so good, I can hardly describe it. Sort of like my whole body is a harmonica, and the music give me goosebumps when I play it. Mostly the trick is in the tongue, lips, fingers, and how you move your neck. I think perhaps running after all them passes has caused my tongue to hang out longer, which is a hell of a note, so to speak. Next Friday, I get all slicked up, and Bubba lend me some hair tonic and shaving lotion, and I go on over to the Student Union building. There's a big crowd there, and sure enough, Jenny Curran and three or four other people is up on stage. Jenny is wearing a long dress and playing the guitar, and somebody else has a banjo, and there's a guy with a bull fiddle plucking it with his fingers. They sound real good. And Jenny seen me back in the crowd and smiles and points with her eyes for me to come up and sit in the front. It's just beautiful sitting there on the floor, listening and watching Jenny Curran. I was kind of thinking that later I'd buy some divinity and see if she wanted some too. They had played for an hour or so, and everybody seemed happy and feeling good. They was playing Joan Baez music and Bob Dylan and Peter, Paul, and Mary. I was lying back with my eyes closed, listening, and all of a sudden, I ain't sure what happened, but I'd pulled out my harmonica and was just playing along with them. It was the strangest thing. Jenny was singing Blowing in the Wind, and when I begun to play, she stopped for a second, and the banjo player, he stopped too. And they get this very surprised looks on their faces, and then Jenny give me a big grin, and she commenced to pick up the song again, and the banjo player, he stopped and give me a chance to ride my harmonica for a while. And everybody in the crowd begun to clap and cheer when I was done. Jenny come down from the stage after that, and the band take a break, and she say, "Forrest, what in the world? Where did you learn to play that thing?" Anyhow, after that, Jenny got me to play with their band. It was every Friday, and when there wasn't an out-of-town game, I made 25 bucks a night. It were just like heaven, till I found out Jenny Curran been screwing the banjo player. Unfortunately, it was not going so good in English class. Mr. Boone had called me in about a week or so after he read my autobiography to the class, and he said, "Mr. Gump, I believe it is time for you to stop trying to be amusing and start getting serious." He handed me back an assignment I'd writ on the poet Wordsworth. "The Romantic period," he say, "did not follow a bunch of classic bullshit, nor were the poets Pope and Dryden a couple of turds." He tell me to do the thing over again, and I'm beginning to realize Mr. Boone don't understand I'm an idiot. But he's about to find out. Meantime, somebody must have said something to somebody, 'cause one day my guidance counselor at the athletic department called me in and tells me I'm excused from other classes and to report the next morning to a Dr. Mills at the University Medical Center. Bright and early, I go over there, and Dr. Mills got a big stack of papers in front of him, looking through them, and he tells me to sit down and start asking me questions. When he finished, he tell me to take off my clothes, all but my undershorts, which I breathed easier after hearing 'cause of what happened the last time with the army doctors, and he commenced to studying me real hard, looking in my eyes and all, and bonging me on the kneecaps with a little rubber hammer. Afterward, Dr. Mills asked if I would mind coming back that afternoon and asked if I would bring my harmonica with me 'cause he heard about it and would I mind playing a tune for one of his medical classes. I said I would, although it seemed peculiar even to somebody dumb as me. There was about 100 people in the medical class, all wearing green aprons and taking notes. Dr. Mills put me up on the stage in a chair with a pitcher and a glass of water in front of me. He's saying a whole bunch of crap I don't follow, but after a while, I get the feeling he's talking about me. "Idiot savant," he say loudly, and everybody be staring my way. "A person who cannot tie a necktie, who can barely lace up his shoes, who has the mental capacity of perhaps a 6 to 10 year old, and in this case the body of, well, an Adonis."
Dr. Mills be smiling at me in a way I don't like, but I'm stuck, I guess. But the mind, he says, the mind of the idiot savant has rare pockets of brilliance, so that Forrest here can solve advanced mathematical equations that would stump any of you, and he can pick up complex musical themes with the ease of Liszt or Beethoven. Idiot savant, he says again, sweeping his hand in my direction. I ain't sure what I'm supposed to do, but he'd said for me to play something, so I pull out the harmonica and start playing Puff the Magic Dragon. Everybody's sitting there watching me like I'm a bug or something, and when the song's over, they still just sitting there looking at me, don't even clap or nothing. I figured they don't like it, so I stood up and said, thanks, and I left. Shit on them people. There is only two more things the rest of that school term that was even halfway important. The first was when we won the National College Football Championship and went to the Orange Bowl. And the second was when I found out Jenny Curran was screwing the banjo player. It was the night we were supposed to play at a fraternity house party at the university. We had a terribly hard practice that afternoon, and I was so thirsty I could have drank out of the toilet like a dog. But there's this little store, 5 or 6 blocks from the Ape Dorm, and after practice I walked on up there, fixing me to get some limes and some sugar, and fix me a limeade, like my mama used to make for me. There is an old cross-eyed woman behind the counter, and she look at me like I'm a hold-up man or something. I'm looking for the limes, and after a while she says, can I help you? And I says, want some limes? And she tells me they ain't got no limes, so I asked her if they got any lemons, because I was thinking a lemonade would do, but they ain't got none of them either, or oranges or nothing. It ain't that kind of store. I must have looked around, maybe an hour or more, and the woman be getting nervous, and finally she say, ain't you gonna buy nothing? So I get a can of peaches off the shelf and some sugar, thinking if I can't have anything else, maybe I can make me a peachade or something. I'm about dying of thirst. When I get back to my basement, I open the can with a knife and squash the peaches up inside one of my socks and strain it into a jar. Then I put in some water and sugar and get it stirred up. But I tell you what, it don't taste nothing like a limeade. Matter of fact, it tastes more than anything else like hot socks. Anyhow, I was supposed to be at the fraternity house at 7 o'clock, and when I get there, some of the fellas is setting up the stuff and all, but Jenny and the banjo guy are nowhere to be found. I asked around for a while, and then I went out to get myself some fresh air in the parking lot. I saw Jenny's car and thought maybe she'd just get here. All the windows in the car is steamed up, so as you can't see inside. Well, all of a sudden, I think maybe she's in there and can't get out, and maybe getting that exhaust poison or something. So I open the door and look in. When I do, the light come on. There she is, lying on the back seat, the top of her dress pulled down and the bottom pulled up. Banjo player there, too, on top of her. Jenny seen me and start screaming and flailing just like she done in the picture show, and it suddenly occurred to me that maybe she being molested. So's I grabbed the banjo player by his shirt, which is all he's got on anyhow, and snatched his ass off her. Well, it didn't take no idiot to figure out that I gone and done the wrong thing again. Jesus Christ, you can't imagine such carrying on. He cussing me, she cussing me, trying to get her dress pulled up and down. And finally Jenny say, "Oh, Forrest, how could you?" And walk off. Banjo player pick up his banjo and leave too. Anyhow, after that it were apparent I was not welcome to play in the little band no more. And I went on back to the basement. I still couldn't understand exactly what had been going on. But later that night, Bubba seen my light on and he stopped down. And when I tell him about the thing, he say, "Good grief, Forrest. Them people was making love." Well, I reckon I might have figured that out myself. But to be honest, it wasn't something I wanted to know. Sometimes, however, a man got to look at the facts. It's probably a good thing I was kept busy playing football, because it was such an awful feeling realizing Jenny was doing that with the banjo player, and that she probably hadn't even a thought about me in that regard. But by this time, we was undefeated the entire season and was going to play for the national championship at the Orange Bowl against them corn shuckers from Nebraska. It was always a big thing when we played a team from up north, because for sure they'd have colored on their side, and that'd be a reason for a lot of consternation from some of the guys, like my ex-roommate Curtis, for example. Although I never worried about it myself, on account of most of the colored I ever met be nicer to me than white people. Anyhow, we going on down to the Orange Bowl in Miami, and come game time, we is some kind of stirred up. Coach Bryant come in the locker room and don't say much, except that if we want to win, we got to play hard or some such. And then we be out on the field. And they kicked off to us. The ball come directly to me, and I grab it out of the air and run straight into a pile of Nebraska corn-shucking niggers and big old white boys that weigh about 500 pounds apiece. It was that way the whole afternoon. At halftime, they was ahead 28-7. And we was a forlorn and sorry lot of guys. Coach Bryant come into the dressing room, and he be shaking his head like he expected all along that we was going to let him down. And then he started drawing on the chalkboard and talking to Snake, the quarterback, and some of the others, and then he called out my name and asked me to come with him into the hallway. "Forrest," he says, "this shit has got to stop." His face right up against mine, and I can feel his breath hot on my cheeks. "Forrest," he say, "all year long we've been running them pass patterns to you in secret, and you've been doing great. Now, we is going to do it against them Nebraska cone jackoffs this second half, and they will be so faked out they jockstraps going to be dangling around their ankles. But it is up to you, boy. So go out there and run like a wild animal is after you." I nod my head, and then it be time to get back on the field. Everybody be hollering and cheering, but I sort of feel there's an unfair burden on my shoulders. What the hell, though? That's just the way it is sometimes. First play, when we get the ball, Snake, the quarterback, say in the huddle, "Okay, "We're going to run the forest series now." And he says to me, "You just run out 20 yards and look back and the ball be there." And damn if it won't. Score is 28-14 all of a sudden. We play real good after that, except them Nebraska corn jerk-off niggers and big old dumb white boys. They ain't just sitting there observing the scene. They's got some tricks of their own. Mainly like running all over us as if we was made of cardboard or something. But they's still somewhat surprised that I can catch the ball. And after I catch it 4 or 5 more times and the score's 28-21, they begin to put 2 fellers to chasing after me. However, that leave Gwen, the end, with nobody much to chase him around, and he catch Snake's pass and put us on the 15-yard line. Weasel, the place kicker, get a field goal, and the score now be 28-24. On the sideline, Coach Bryant come up to me and say, "Forrest, you may be a shit for brains, but you has got to pull this thing out for us. I will personally see that you are made President of the United States or whatever else you want if you can just haul that football over the goal line 1 more time." He pat me on the head then, like I was a dog, and back in the game I go. The Snake, he get caught behind the line right at the first play, and the clock is running out fast. On the second play, he tried to fake him out by handing me the ball instead of throwing it. But about 2 tons of Nebraska corn jack-off beef, black and white, fall on top of me right away. I lying there, flat on my back, thinking what it must have been like when that net load of bananas fall on my daddy. And then I gone back in the huddle again. "Forrest," Snake says, "I gonna fake a pass to Gwen, but I am gonna throw the ball to you. So I want you to run down there to the cornerback and then turn right and the ball be right there." Snake's eyes are wild as a tiger's. I nod my head and do as I'm told. Sure enough, Snake heaves the ball into my hands, and I be tearing toward the middle of the field with the goalpost straight ahead. But all of a sudden, a giant man come flying into me and slow me down. And then all the Nebraska cone jerk-off niggers and big old dumb white boys in the world start grappin' and gouging and stomping on me. And I fall down. Damn. We ain't got but a few yards to go for winning the game. When I get off my back, I see Snake got everybody lined up already for the last play on account of we got no more timeouts. Soon as I get to my place, he calls for the snap and I run out. But he suddenly throwed the ball about 20 feet over my head, out of bounds on purpose, to stop the clock, I guess, which only has 2 or 3 seconds left on it. Unfortunately, though, Snake done got confused about things. I suppose he thinking it 3rd down and we got 1 more play left, but in fact it were 4th down. So we lose the ball and also, of course, we lose the game. Sound like something I would have done. Anyhow, it was extra sad for me, because I kind of figured Jenny Curran was probably watching the game, and maybe if I done got the ball and win the game, she'd try to forgive me for doing what I'd done to her. But that were not to be. Coach Bryant were mighty unhappy over what happened, but he suck it up and say, "Well, boys, there's always next year." except for me, that is. That was not to be either.
Chapter 5.
After the Orange Bowl, the athletic department get my grades for the first term, and it ain't long before Coach Bryant sent for me to come to his office. When I get there, he looking bleak. "Forrest," he say, "I can understand how you flunked remedial English, but it will mystify me to the end of my days how you managed to get an A in something called intermediate light and then an F in phys ed class, when you has just been named the most valuable college back in the Southeastern Conference." It was a long story that I didn't want to bore Coach Bryant with, but why in hell do I need to know the distance between goalposts on a soccer field anyway? Well, Coach Bryant, looking at me with a terrible, sad expression on his face, "Forrest," he say, "I regret awfully having to tell you this, but you's done flunked out of school, and there's nothing I can do." I just stood there, twisting my hands, till it suddenly come to me what he's saying. "I ain't gonna get to play no more football. I got to leave the university. Maybe I never see any of the other guys no more. Maybe I never see Jenny Curran no more either. I got to move out of my basement, and I won't get to take advanced light next term like Professor Hooks have said I would." I didn't realize it, but tears begun coming to my eyes. I ain't saying nothing, I just standing there, head hanging down. Then Coach, he stand up himself and come over to me, and he put his arm round me. He say, "Forrest, it okay, son. When you first come here, I expect something like this would happen. But I told him then, I said, just give me that boy for one season, that's all I ask." Well, Forrest, we has had ourselves one hell of a season. That is for sure. And it certainly weren't your fault that Snake throwed the ball out of bounds on fourth down. I looked up then, and there's little tears in Coach's eyes too, and he's looking at me real hard. "Forrest," he say, "there has never been nobody like you ever played ball at this school, and there won't be never again. You was very fine." And Coach go over and stand looking out the window, and he say, "Good luck, boy. Now get your big dumb ass out of here." And so I had to leave the university. I gone back and pack up my shit in the basement. Bubba come down and he done brought two beers, give one to me. I ain't never drank a beer, but I can see how a fella could acquire a taste for it. Bubba walk with me outside the ape dorm, and lo and behold, who should be standing there but the entire football team. They's very quiet, and Snake, he come up and shake my hand and say, "Forrest, I'm very sorry about that pass, okay?" And I says, "Sure, Snake, okay." And then they all come up one by one and shake my hand. Even old Curtis, who's wearing a body brace from his neck down on account of bashing down one door too many in the ape dorm. Bubba say he'd help me carry my shit down to the bus depot, but I say I'd rather go alone. Keep in touch, he say. Anyhow, on the way to the bus station, I pass by the student union store. But it ain't Friday night, and Jenny Curran's band is not playing. So I say the hell with it, and catch the bus on home. It was late at night when the bus got to Mobile. I hadn't told my mama what had happened, 'cause I knew she'd be upset. So I walk on home, but there's a light on up in her room, and when I get inside, there she is, crying and bawling just like I remember. What had happened, she tell me, is that the United States Army has already heard about me not making my grades, and that very day a notice done come for me to report to the U.S. Army Induction Center. If I'd known then what I know now, I'd never have done it. My mama take me down there a few days later. She's packed me a box lunch in case I get hungry on the way to wherever we's going. There's about 100 guys standing around and 4 or 5 buses waiting. A big old sergeant be hollering and yelling at everybody, and mama goes up to him and says, I don't see how you can take my boy, 'cause he's an idiot. But the sergeant just looked back at her and say, well, lady, what do you think all these other people is, Einsteins? And he gone on back to hollering and yelling. Pretty soon he yell at me too, and I get on the bus, and away we went. Ever since I left the nut school, people been shouting at me. Coach Fellers, Coach Bryant, and the goons, and now the people in the Army. But let me say this. Them people in the Army yell longer and louder and nastier than anybody else. They is never happy. And furthermore, they do not complain that you's dumb or stupid like coaches do. They's more interested in your private parts or bowel movements, and so always precede their yelling with something like dickhead or asshole. Sometimes I wonder if Curtis had been in the Army before he went to play football. Anyhow, after about 100 hours on the bus, we get to Fort Benning, Georgia, and all I'm thinking is 35-3, the score when we whoop them Georgia dogs. The conditions in the barracks is actually a little better than they was in the ape dorm, but the food is not. It is terrible, although there's a lot of it. Other than that, it was just doing what they told us and getting yelled at in the months to come. They taught us to shoot guns, throw hand grenades, and crawl around on our bellies. When we wasn't doing that, we was either running someplace or cleaning toilets and things. The one thing I remember from Fort Benning is that they didn't seem to be nobody much smarter than I was, which was certainly a relief. Not too long after I arrive, I get put on KP, on account of I have accidentally shot a hole in the water tower when we was down at the rifle range. When I get to the kitchen, it seems the cook is took sick or something, and somebody point to me and say, Gump, you's gonna be a cook today. What I'm gonna cook? I asked. I ain't never cooked before. Who cares? Somebody say. This ain't the Sans Souci, you know. Why don't you make stew? Somebody else say. It's easier. What of? I asked. Look in the icebox in the pantry, the fellow say. Just throw in everything you see and boil it up. What if it don't taste good? I asked. Who gives a shit? You ever eat anything around here that did?
In this, he is correct. Well, I commenced to get everything I could from the iceboxes and the pantry. There was cans of tomatoes and beans and peaches and bacon and rice and bags of flour and sacks of potatoes and I don't know what all else. I gathered it all together and said to one of the guys, what I'm going to cook it in. There's some pots in the closet, he say. But when I looked in the closet, there's just small pots and certainly not large enough to cook a stew for 200 men in the company.
March asked the lieutenant, somebody say. He's out in the field on maneuvers, come the reply. I don't know, say one fella. But when them guys get back here today, they're going to be damn hungry. So you better think of something.
What about this? I asked. There was an enormous iron thing about 6 feet high and 5 feet around sitting in the corner.
That? That's a goddamn steam boiler. You can't cook nothing in there.
How come? I say.
Well, I don't know. I just wouldn't do it if I was you.
Well, it's hot. It's got water in it, I says.
Do what you want, somebody say. We got other shit to do.
And so, I used the steam boiler. I opened all the cans and peeled all the potatoes and throwed in whatever meat I could find and onions and carrots and poured in 10 or 20 bottles of ketchup and mustard and all. After about an hour, you could begin to smell the stew cooking.
How's the dinner coming? Somebody asks after a while.
Well, I'll go taste it, I say. I unfastened the lid to the boiler, and there it was. You could see all the shit bubbling and boiling up, and ever so often an onion or a potato would come to the top and float around.
Let me taste it, a feller asked. He took a tin cup and dipped out some stew. Say, this shit ain't near done yet, he says. You better turn up the heat. Them fellas will be here any minute.
So I turned up the heat on the boiler, and sure enough, the company begun coming in from the field. You can hear 'em in the barracks taking showers and getting dressed for the evening meal. And it weren't long afterward that they begun arriving in the mess hall. But the stew still wasn't ready. I tasted it again, and some things were still raw. Out in the mess hall, they begun a kind of disgruntled mumbling that soon turned into chanting, and so I turned the boiler up again. After a half hour or so, they's beating on the tables with their knives and forks like in a prison riot, and I knowed I had to do something fast, so I turned the boiler up high as it could go. I'm sitting there watching it, so nervous I didn't know what to do, when all of a sudden the first sergeant come busting through the door.
"What in hell's going on here?" he asked. "Where is these men's food?"
It's almost ready, Sergeant, I say. And just about then, the boiler commences to rumble and shake. Steam begun to come out of the sides, and one of the legs on the boiler tore loose from the floor.
What's that? The sergeant asks. Is you cooking something in that boiler?
That's the supper, I says. And the sergeant got this real amazed look on his face, and a second later, he got a real frightened look like you might get just for an automobile wreck. And then, the boiler blew up. I'm not exactly sure what happened next. I do remember that it blowed the roof off the mess hall, and blowed all the windows out, and the doors too. It blowed the dishwasher guy right through a wall, and the guy what was stacking plates just
took off up in the air, sort of like Rocket Man. Sergeant and me, we is miraculously spared somehow, like they say'll happen when you're so close to a hand grenade that you aren't hurt by it. But somehow it blowed both our clothes off, except for the big chef's hat I was wearing at the time, and it blowed stew all over us, so's we looked like, well, I don't know what we looked like, but man, it was strange. Incredibly, it didn't do nothing to all them guys sitting out there in the mess hall, neither. Just left 'em sitting at their tables covered with stew, acting kind of shell-shocked or something. But it sure did shut their asses up about when their food is going to be ready. Suddenly, the company commander come running into the building. "What was that?" he shouted. "What happened?" He looked at the two of us and then hollers, "Sergeant Krantz, is that you?" "Gump, boiler, stew," the sergeant say. Then he kind of get hold of himself and grabbed a meat cleaver off the wall. "Gump, boiler, stew!" He scream and come after me with the cleaver. I done run out the door, and he be chasing me all over the parade grounds, even through the officer's club and the motor pool. I outrunned him, though, 'cause that's my specialty. But let me say this. There ain't no question in my mind that I am up the creek for sure. One night, the next fall, the phone rung in the barracks, and it was Bubba. He say they done dropped his athletic scholarship 'cause his foot broke worse than they thought, and so he's leaving school too. But he asks if I can get off to come up to Birmingham to watch the university play them geeks from Mississippi. But I am confined to quarters that Saturday, as I have been every weekend since the stew blowed up, and that's nearly a year. Anyway, I can't do it, so I listen to the game on the radio while I'm scrubbing out the latrine. The score is very close at the end of the third quarter, and Snake is having himself a big day. It's 38-37 our way, but the geeks from Mississippi score a touchdown with only 1 minute to go. Suddenly, it's fourth down and no more timeouts for us. I prayin' silently that Snake don't do what he done at the Orange Bowl, which is to throw the ball out of bounds on fourth down and lose the game again. But that is exactly what he done. My heart sunk low, but suddenly there's all sorts of cheering so you can't hear the radio announcer, and when it's all quieted down, what happened was this. The Snake done faked an out-of-bounds pass on fourth down to stop the clock, but he actually give the ball to Curtis, who run it in for the winning touchdown. That'll give you some idea just how crafty Coach Bryant is. He done already figured them geeks from Mississippi is so dumb they will assume we is stupid enough to make the same mistake twice. I'm real happy about the game, but I'm wondering if Jenny Curran is watching and if she's thinking of me. As it turned out, it don't matter anyhow, 'cause a month later, we shipped out. For nearly a year, we's been trained like robots and are going to somewhere 10,000 miles away, and that is no exaggeration. We is going to Vietnam, but they says it's not nearly as bad as what we's gone through this past year. As it turned out, though, that is an exaggeration. We got there in February and was trucked on cattle cars from Quy Nhon on the South China Sea coast up to Pleiku in the highlands. It wasn't a bad ride, and the scenery was nice and interesting, with banana trees and palms and rice paddies with little gooks plowing in 'em. Everybody on our side is real friendly, too, waving at us and all. We could see Play Coo almost half a day away on account of a humongous cloud of red dust that hovered over it. On its outskirts was sad little shanties that is worse than anything I seen back in Alabama, with folks huddled neath cloth lean-tos and ain't got no teeth, and the children ain't got no clothes, and basically they is beggars. When we get to the brigade headquarters and fire base, it don't look real bad either, except for all that red dust. Ain't nothing much going on that we can see, and the place is all neat and clean, with tents stretched far as you can see in rows, and the dirt and sand around 'em raked up nice and tidy. Don't hardly look like a war going on at all. We might as well been back at Fort Benning. Anyhow, they says it's real quiet 'cause it's the beginning of the Gook New Year's, Tets or some such, and there's a truce going on. All of us is tremendously relieved, because we's frightened enough as it is. The peace and quiet, however, didn't last very long. After we get squared away in our area, they tell us to go down to brigade showers and clean ourselves. Brigade showers is just a shallow pit in the ground where they's put three or four big water tank trucks, and we told to fold our uniforms up on the edge of the pit and then get down in there and they'll squirt us with water. Even so, it ain't half bad, account of we've been for nearly a week without a bath and was beginning to smell pretty ripe. We is assing around in the pit, getting hosed down and all, and it's just about getting dark. And all of a sudden, there's this funny sound in the air. And some jack-off who's squirting us with the hose holler, "Incoming!" And everybody on the edge of the pit vanish into thin air. We standing there, butt naked, looking at each other. And then there's a big explosion close by, and then another one. And everybody starts shouting and cussing and trying to get to their clothes. Them incoming explosions falling all around us, and somebody shouting, "Hit the dirt!" Which was kind of ridiculous, since we was all pressed so flat in the bottom of the pit by now, we resemble worms rather than people. One of them explosions send a bunch of shit flying into our pit, and them boys on the far side get hit with it and start screaming and yelling and bleeding and grappin' at themselves. It were all too apparent that the pit was not a safe place to be hiding. Sergeant Krantz suddenly appear over the edge of the pit, and he holler for us all to get the hell out of there and follow him. There's a little break between explosions, and we haul ass out of the pit. I come over the top and look down, and God almighty, lying there's four or five of the fellas who was squirting the hose on us. They's hardly recognizable as people, all mangled up like they's been stuffed through a cotton baler or something. I ain't never seen nobody dead, and it is the most horrible and scary thing ever to happen to me afore or since. Sergeant Krantz motioned for us to crawl after him, which we do. If you could have looked down on it from above, we must have made a sight. 150 or so fellas all butt naked, squirming along the ground in a long line. There's a bunch of foxholes dug in a row, and Sergeant Krantz put three or four of us in each hole. But as soon as we get in 'em, I realized I'd have almost rather stayed back in the pit. Them foxholes was filled waist stinking deep with slimy old water from the rain. And there was all sorts of frogs and snakes and bugs crawling and leaping and squirming around in 'em. It went on the entire night, and we had to stay in them foxholes and didn't get no supper. Just before dawn, the shelling eased up, and we was told to haul our asses out of the foxholes and get our clothes and weapons and prepare for the attack. Since we was relatively new, there was really not much we could do. They didn't even know where to put us, so they told us to go guard the south perimeter, which is where the officer's latrine was located. But it were nearly worse than the foxholes, on account of one of the bombs has hit the latrine and blowed up about 500 pounds of officer shit all over the area. We had to stay there all day. No breakfast, no lunch. And then at sundown, they commenced shelling us again, so we had to lie there in all that shit. My, my, it were repulsive. Finally, somebody remember we might be getting hungry and had a bunch of sea ration cases brought over. I got the cold ham and eggs that was dated 1951 on the can. There was all kinds of rumors going on. Somebody said the Gooks was running over the town to play coup. Somebody else says the Gooks got an atomic bomb and is just shelling us with mortars to soften us up. And somebody else says it ain't the Gooks shelling us at all, but Australians, or maybe the Dutch or the Norwegians. I figure, don't matter who it is. Shit on rumors. Anyhow, after the first day, we begun trying to make ourselves a livable place on the south perimeter. We dug us foxholes and used the boards and tin from the officer's latrine to make us little hooches. The attack never come, though, and we never saw no Gooks to shoot at. I figure maybe they smart enough not to attack a shithouse anyway. Every night, for about 3 or 4 days, they shelling us, though, and finally one morning when the shelling stops, Major Balls, the battalion executive officer, come crawling up to our company commander and say we's got to go up north to help out another brigade that is catching hell in the jungle. After a while, Lieutenant Hooper say for us to saddle up, and everybody stuffing as many sea rations and hand grenades in his pockets as he can. Which actually present a sort of dilemma, since you can't eat a hand grenade, but you might nevertheless come to need it. Anyway, they load us on the helicopters, and off we flew. You could see the shit 3rd Brigade had stepped into even before the helicopters landed. There was all sorts of smoke and stuff rising up out of the jungle, and huge chunks had been blown out of the ground. We hadn't even got to earth before they commenced shooting at us. They blowed up one of our helicopters in the air, and it was a dreadful sight. People set on fire and all, and nothing we could do. I am the machine gun ammo bearer, 'cause they figure I can carry a lot of shit on account of my size. Before we left, a couple of other fellas asked if I'd mind carrying some of their hand grenades so's they could carry more sea rations, and I agreed. Didn't hurt me none. Also, Sergeant Krantz made me carry a 10-gallon water can that weighed about 50 pounds. Then, just before we left, Daniels, who carries the tripod for the machine gun, he gets the runs and he can't go. So's I got to tote the tripod, too. When it all added up, I might as well have been toting around one of them Nebraska corn chucker jackoffs as well. But this ain't no football game. It is getting to be dusk, and we is told to go up to a ridge and relieve Charlie Company, which is either pinned down by the Gooks or has got the Gooks pinned down, depending on whether you get your news from the Stars and Stripes or by just looking around at what the hell's going on. In any event, when we get up there, all sorts of crap is flying around, and there's about a dozen fellas badly hurt and moaning and crying, and there's so much noise from all quarters that nobody can hardly hear nothing.
I be crouching down real low and trying to get all that ammo and the water can and the tripod plus all my own shit up to where Charlie Company is, and I'm struggling past the slit trench when this guy down in it pipe up and say to the other, "Look at that big bozo. He looked like the Frankenstein monster or something." And I'm about to say something back, 'cause things seem bad enough already without nobody poking fun at you. But then, I'll be damned, the other guy in the slit trench suddenly jump up and cry out, "Forrest! Forrest Gump!" Lo and behold, it was Bubba. Briefly, what had happened was that even if Bubba's foot was hurt too bad to play football, it weren't bad enough to keep from getting him sent halfway around the earth on behalf of the United States Army. Anyhow, I dragged my sorry butt and everything else up to where I was supposed to be, and after a while, Bubba come up there, and in between the shelling, which stop every time our airplanes appear, Bubba and me caught up with each other. He tells me he hear Jenny Curran done quit school and gone off with a bunch of war protesters or something. He also say that Curtis done beat up a campus policeman one day for giving him a parking ticket and was in the process of drop-kicking his official ass around the campus when the authorities show up and throw a big net over Curtis and drug him off. Bubba say Coach Bryant made Curtis run 50 extra laps after practice as punishment. Good old Curtis.
Chapter 6.
That night was long and uncomfortable. We couldn't fly our airplanes, so they got to shell us most of the evening for free. There was a little saddle between two ridges, and they was on one ridge, and we on the other, and down in the saddle was where the dispute were taking place. Though what anybody would want with that piece of mud and dirt, I do not know. However, Sergeant Krantz have said to us time and again that we was not brought over here to understand what is going on, only to do what we is told. Pretty soon, Sergeant Krantz come up and start telling us what to do. He says we's got to move the machine gun about 50 meters around to the left of a big old tree sticking up in the middle of the saddle and find a good safe place to put it so as we's not all blowed away. From what I seen here, any place, including where we presently are, is not safe, but to go down in that saddle is goddamn absurd. However, I'm trying to do the right thing. Me and Bones, the machine gunner, and Doyle, another ammo bearer, and two other guys crawl out of our holes and start to moving down the little slope. Halfway down, the gooks see us and commence to shooting with their own machine gun. Before anything bad happens, though, we scramble down the slope and into the jungle. I cannot remember how far a meter is exactly, but it is almost the same as a yard. So, when we get near the big tree, I say to Doyle, "Maybe we better move left." And he look at me real hard-like and growl, "Shut your ass, Forrest, there's gooks here." Sure enough, they was 6 or 8 gooks squatting under the big old tree having their lunch. Doyle take a hand grenade and pull the pin and sort of lob it into the air toward the tree. It blowed up before it hit the ground, and there's all sorts of wild chattering from where the gooks is. And then Bones opens up with the machine gun, and me and two other guys heaving a couple of more hand grenades for good measure. All that gone down in just a minute or so, and when it come quiet again, we be on our way. We found a place to put the gun and stayed there till it got dark, and all night long too, but nothing happened.
We could hear all sorts of shit going on every place else, but we'd be left to ourselves. Sun up come, and we hungry and tired, but there we is. Then a runner come from Sergeant Krantz, who say Charlie Company is going to start moving into the saddle soon as our airplanes have totally wiped out the gooks there, which is to be in a few minutes. Sure enough, the planes come and drop they shit, and everything get exploded and wipe out all the gooks. We can see Charlie Company moving off the ridge line, coming down into the saddle, but no sooner does they get over the edge of the ridge and start struggling along the slope than all the weapons in the world commence to shooting at Charlie Company and dropping mortars and all, and it is terrible confusion. From where we is, we cannot see any gooks on account of the jungle as thick as bonfire brush, but somebody sure be in there shooting at Charlie Company. Maybe it's the Dutch, or even the Norwegians, who knows? Bones, the machine gunner, looking extremely nervous during all this on account of he's already figured out that the shooting is coming from in front of us, meaning that the gooks is in between us and our own position. In other words, we is out here alone. Sooner or later, he says, if the gooks do not overrun Charlie Company, they will come back this way. And if they find us here, they will not like it one bit. Point is, we got to move our asses. We get our shit together and begin to work back towards the ridge, but as we do, Doyle suddenly looked down off our right to the bottom of the saddle, and he see an entire busload of new gooks armed to the teeth moving up the hill toward Charlie Company. Best thing we could have done then was to try and make friends with them and forget all this other shit, but that was not in the cards. So we just hunkered down in some big old shrubs and waited until they got to the top of the hill. Then Bones let loose with the machine gun, and he must have killed 10 or 15 of them gooks right off. Doyle and me and the other two guys is throwing grenades, and things is going our way until Bones runs out of ammo and needs a fresh belt. I feed one in for him, but just as he about to squeeze the trigger, a gook bullet hit him square in the head and bloated inside out. He lying on the ground, hand still holding to the gun for dear life, which he did not have any more of now. Oh, God, it were awful, and getting worse. No telling what them gooks would have done if they caught us. I call out to Doyle to come here, but there's no answer. I jerk the machine gun from poor old Bones' fingers and squirm over to Doyle, but he and the two other guys lay in their shot. They dead, but Doyle still breathing, so as I grab him up and throw him over my shoulder like a flour sack and start running through the brush toward Charlie Company, 'cause I scared out of my wits. I running for maybe 20 yards, and bullets whizzing all round me from behind, and I figure I'd be shot in the ass for sure. But then I crash through a canebrake and come upon an area with low grass, and to my surprise is filled with gooks, lying down looking the other way and shooting at Charlie Company, I guess. Now what I do? I got gooks behind me, gooks in front of me, and gooks right under my feet. I don't know what else to do. So I charge up full speed and start to bellowing and howling and all. I sort of lose my head, I guess, 'cause I don't remember what happened next, except I still be bellowing and hollering loud as I can, running for dear life. Everything was completely confused. Then all of a sudden, I'm in the middle of Charlie Company, and everybody be slapping me on the back, just like I made a touchdown. It seemed like I done frightened off the gooks, and they hightail it back to wherever they live. I put down Doyle on the ground, and the medics come and start fixing him up, And pretty soon the Charlie Company commander come up to me and start pumping my hand and telling me what a good fella I am. And then he say, "How in the hell did you do that, Gump?" He'd be waiting for an answer, but I don't know how I done it myself. So I says, "I got to pee," which I did. The company commander look at me real strange, and then look at Sergeant Krantz, who'd also come up, and Sergeant Krantz say, "Oh, for Christ's sake, Gump, come with me," and he take me behind a tree. That night, Bubba and me meet up and share a foxhole and eat our sea rations for supper. Afterward, I get out my harmonica Bubba had gave me. We play a few tunes. Sound real eerie there in the jungle, playing "Oh, Susanna" and "Home on the Range." Bubba got a little box of candy his mama sent him, pralines and divinity, and we both ate some. And let me tell you this, that divinity sure brung back some memories. Later on, Sergeant Krantz come over and asked me where's the 10-gallon can of drinking water. I told him I done left it out in the jungle when I was trying to carry in Doyle and the machine gun. For a minute, I think he gonna make me go back out there and get it, but he don't. He just nod and say that since Doyle is hurt and Bones is killed, now I got to be the machine gunner. I asked him who gonna carry the tripod and the ammo and all, and he say I got to do that too, 'cause nobody else left to do it. Then Bubba say he'll do it if he can get transferred to our company. Sergeant Krantz think about that for a minute. Then he say it can probably be arranged, since there ain't enough left to Charlie Company to clean the latrine anyway. And so it was. Bubba and me is together again.
This ends Disc 2.